This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, weeks of sustained raids, invasions, attacks, and killings by Israeli forces and Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank. We'll speak with an eyewitness to recent violence in Jerusalem's Shuafat refugee camp after a 16-year-old Palestinian boy was allegedly kidnapped and murdered by Israeli settlers on Tuesday.
The Israelis were deployed here in the hundreds, heavily armed, and basically youth on the other side throwing stones, and this kept going for the whole day.
Ayed Abu Ektesh of Defense for Children International Palestine section talks about Israel's policies of collective punishment and the attacks against Palestinian children over the last 3 weeks. Also, Rami Al-Megari reports from the Gaza Strip, where the Israeli military bombed more than 30 sites early Tuesday morning. A sports fan in Houston, Texas, brings her Palestinian flag to a soccer match and is told her flag is, quote, a racist slur by stadium security. And a report from Chicago, how a son of Palestinian immigrants became one of the city's busiest barbers. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Oakland, with Nader Hamoud in Chicago. Since the bodies of three missing Israeli youths were discovered in the occupied West Bank on Monday, Israeli politicians have whipped the public up with demands for, quote, revenge. Videos posted by the Electronic Intifada show disturbing footage of significant crowds of young Israelis marching through the streets of Jerusalem on Tuesday evening, chanting death to the Arabs, Mavet la'aravim in Hebrew. Following the racist mob rallies, Palestinian youth Mohammed Abu Khader, 16, was reported by residents of Shuafat in eastern occupied Jerusalem to have been kidnapped. Witnesses said, quote, footage from surveillance cameras shows Israelis stepping out of a Hyundai in front of Abu Khader's house and forcing the teen inside before speeding off, Ma'an News Agency reported. On Tuesday morning, Abu Khader's badly burned body was later found by police in a wooded area and positively identified. Immediately after the news of the teenager's murder, Israeli police sealed off and closed the area around Shuafat, and youths clashed with occupation forces for 2 days. The Twitter user BDS4Justice, whose Twitter handle is Zalame, lives in the area and was posting regular updates. In a report by Al-Akhbar and Agence France-Presse on Thursday, quote, clashes which had raged in Shuafat throughout Wednesday spread during the evening to other areas of annexed East Jerusalem, including Silwan, Issawiya, Ras Al-Amud, and Annata. According to figures from Dr. Amin Abu Ghazali, head of field operations for the Red Crescent in East Jerusalem, 232 people were wounded during the clashes, 178 of them in Shuafat alone. Of that number, 187 Palestinians were wounded by rubber bullets. Other clashes were reported elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, at Kalandia between Jerusalem and Ramallah, as well as in the southern towns of Beit Fajar and Bethlehem, police said. Overnight, Israeli troops arrested 13 Palestinians as it pressed on with an arrest campaign which began when the three Israeli teenagers disappeared while hitchhiking on June 12th. Since their disappearance, Israel has launched a ruthless campaign of house raids and mass arrests in the West Bank, which has been criticized as being tantamount to collective punishment. That was from Al-Akhbar and Agence France-Presse. The International Middle East Media Center reported that on Wednesday at dawn, Israeli soldiers invaded dozens of Palestinian communities in the occupied West Bank and kidnapped at least 44 Palestinians, including a number of political leaders of the Hamas movement, which Israel has blamed for the disappearance and murder of the three Israeli youth. Since the disappearance of the youth, Israeli troops have killed 9 Palestinian civilians and arrested more than 500, including political leaders. Israeli forces raided and ransacked hundreds of Palestinian homes across the West Bank. On Thursday, I spoke with Twitter user BDS4Justice from Shuafat refugee camp. He began by talking about the current situation there in the camp and around occupied East Jerusalem as clashes continued into the third day.
What's happening right now really is a culmination of the past weeks of incitement within the Israeli, both political establishment and the Israeli public in general. Since the three settlers disappeared, Israel implemented a policy of collective punishment of all Palestinians, and that implied closure of Palestinian cities, erection of checkpoints, and even here in Jerusalem, I mean, we have seen escalations of religious zealots and Israeli public in general occupying the public space very visibly. And one example, the recent Jerusalem Day parade, where, you know, the chants that you normally hear is "Death to Arabs." So there's already a buildup happening, you know, in relation to incitement against Palestinians. And this was simply a culmination of, you know, a Palestinian, my neighbor, who lives right next door to me here in Shafat, was taken in early mornings, in early hours by settlers, and he was killed. So there was already an atmosphere where Palestinians were being attacked in more than one ways, both physically, but also being told that you don't belong here, and you know, you have to, you're just a guest. And this is pretty much Israel's policy within Jerusalem, that Palestinians are not part of the city, and this is an exclusivist Jewish city.
Can you talk about what happened on Tuesday in Shafat? Can you talk about what it was like there on Tuesday and continuing into today?
So Muhammad was taken at about 4 a.m. And from the early hours, when we were all, it's the month of Ramadan, so we all woke up to eat. And then after that, we go to the mosque at 4:20. The news started spreading that the boy was taken, and it was taken by settlers. But there was still a lot of confusion whether, you know, what was going to happen, what, you know, will he come back, and so on. And then about 7:30 a.m. local time, after, you know, since 4:30 a.m., people had been gathered at the main road of Shafat, we got the news that the body had been found. And obviously, people's reaction was that they were very angry that this happened to a child from their neighborhood here in Jerusalem, and from there on, I mean, there has been intense clashes throughout the whole day. The Israelis were you know, deployed here in the hundreds, heavily armed, and basically youth on the other side throwing stones, and this kept going for the whole day. And even though, you know, it's really hot right now and people are fasting, but the youth were really angry and determined that they, you know, they kept the clashes going. But it's really interesting to note that this sort of clashes, it's quite rare in East Jerusalem. I mean, you see a lot of it happening often inside the West Bank, in Qalandia, and in other cities within the West Bank, but in East Jerusalem, not so much. So I see this as actually a turning point, but I'm not saying it's a game changer, but it's definitely a turning point. We are getting close to what we can say, a moment where there is a more collective spirit, which was missing for all the last 5 years since Fayyad took over and Abbas's security coordination with the Israelis took over. There was a lack of a collective spirit, and I think now there is this general feeling that they're under attack by the Israelis, plus the decades old occupation and so on. Everything is there, and the emotions are really at the boiling point.
Have you been able to speak with Mohammed Abu Khudair's family? What's the mood like on the ground right now in Shafat 2 days after his murder?
So I went today to the mourning tent of the family. I talked to his cousins, his uncles, and they're really, really, first of all, they're upset that the Israelis haven't released the body yet. People want to mourn for their son, the son of the neighborhood, and you know, and the Israelis have still kept the body. And at the same time, they really don't expect the Israelis to bring justice and bring the perpetrators to accountability. And this is because already the Israelis, from the very beginning, they haven't cooperated in full with the investigations, in the sense that a lot of they're trying to make this also as it is a family feud, and bringing other hypotheses which really are impossible, given that the family itself has a CCTV of the settlers taking the kid from the street, and the Israelis confiscated the CCTV from the neighborhood, not only the official one from the light rail which runs through Shafat, but also so they're not being transparent in this whole process. And by now we would have want answers, and so far no answers have been given. And we know historically also that justice won't come from the Israeli side. From what I've heard today at the morning tent, it's expected that the body will be brought during tonight or tomorrow morning, and so they're expecting to do a burial after Friday prayers. And as you know, not only in Palestine but throughout the Middle East, Fridays is a time, it's a day off, and it's a time where everyone congregates at the mosques. So it's, I think the atmosphere is ripe for protests, not only here in Shafat, where it has been the center of the protests, but throughout East Jerusalem. Adding to this, there is Ramadan, so the Old City and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will be really, really full. And it's really expected, with all of the emotions that of the past couple of days, really for things to erupt. And we know that the Israelis will be ruthless also in their repression.
All right, well, we're going to continue to watch this situation very, very carefully. That's the voice of Twitter user BDS for Justice. With your Twitter handle is Zalame. You're also on Instagram. We will link to your Twitter and Instagram on the Electronic Intifada. Thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast. Please be safe.
Thank you, Nora.
Also joining us from Palestine on Thursday morning was Ayad Abu Akhtesh, Director of the Accountability Program at Defense for Children International Palestine Office. I asked Ayad to bring us up to date with the attacks on Palestinian children, either by the Israeli military or by Israeli settlers, and the impact on children by Israel's collective punishment policies.
Israel started this punitive measures against the Palestinian community after the disappearance of the three settlers in Hebron area. Almost all Palestinian territories have been affected by this collective punishment policy. More than 500 Palestinians were arrested arbitrarily. In some cases, the Israeli authorities issued administrative detention order against some of them. So this policy is not a new policy for the Israelis. When something like that is happening, the ready response is to attack the Palestinian community.
Ayad, can you talk about the impact of the policies of Israel's collective punishment, as we've seen the last 2 weeks, on children?
In general, this policy is not directed. We can't say that this policy has been directed towards children. It was directed towards Palestinian community and Palestinian citizens in general. It was clear through imposing restrictions on the right to movement of Palestinians. The number, for example, of arrested children during this operation almost was the same like usual. So we can say that children were directly affected of this policy. But they were affected as part of the Palestinian community. Operation DCI can confirm that non-Palestinian have been killed, among them one child on the hands of the Israeli army and another child on the hands of the Israeli settlers. At this point, the DCI is investigating and collecting information regarding the killing of a Palestinian boy from East Jerusalem. But there is an indication that his abduction and killing is revenge for the killing of the Israeli settlers. So We are in the process of getting the information from eyewitnesses and collecting information in this regard. But as I said, there are so many cases of attacking children. By the way, the abducting this child is not the only incident. Before, there was an attempt to abduct another child from the same area. And I believe that this policy, or what the Israeli settlers is doing, because the Israeli political leader charged the Israeli settlers in order to revenge. We believe that it's the responsibility of the Israeli government as occupying power to protect the lives of civilians who are living in the occupied territories.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. That's the voice of Ayad Abu Akhtesh. He's the director of the Accountability Program at Defense for Children International's Palestine office. Ayad, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
You're welcome.
We continue our reporting from Palestine. The Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights reported that as part of its attack campaign against Palestinians following the murder of three Israeli teenagers, early Tuesday morning, Israeli warplanes launched several attacks in different areas across the Gaza Strip. According to Al-Mizan's fieldwork unit, Israeli jets launched 17 aerial strikes, causing 5 injuries, including 1 child, and partially damaging 25 homes, 5 greenhouses, and 5 industrial workshops, 3 of which were entirely damaged. On Wednesday night and early Thursday morning, the Ma'an news agency reports 11 Palestinians were injured as Israel again attacked 15 targets in the Gaza Strip. Among those hospitalized includes a 17-year-old boy who sustained shrapnel wounds near Gaza City. 20 rockets were fired at Israel since Wednesday, Israel's army said, with one hitting a home in the city of Sderot, with no injuries reported. The Electronic Intifada's Rami Al-Maghari spoke to us from Gaza on Wednesday about the attacks earlier in the week.
When the airstrikes began on Tuesday, early on a Tuesday dawn, while most of the people here in the Gaza Strip were preparing for the suhoor meal, which is the meal that the people take before their fasting day starts, you know, especially we have Ramadan month these days. Like many people, myself, I was preparing for the meal. At that time, my family was still awake for the meal. For the suhoor meal and the welcoming of the fasting day, a new fasting day, the second fasting day, actually. And that was very horrific for the people of Gaza. The Israeli F-16 jet fighters were hovering overhead, buzzing overhead. That was very horrific. And they started shelling different areas, different locations in the Gaza Strip. Some of the locations just are near the town where my family live. It's about a town that is close to proximate to my town. Others in the south, others in the north of Gaza Strip, different locations actually. There were about more than 30 locations, 30 sites, which Israel says that they belong to Hamas group and other groups in the factions, other armed factions, armed groups in the territory. And these strikes resulted in the injury of four people in southern Gaza Strip, where the Israelis hit a site near one of the evacuated Israeli settlements in southern Gaza. 4 people who are said to be guardsmen of one of the locations there. You know, many of the evacuated settlements are used now for planting, for agriculture, used for entertainment, like amusement parks or something like that, like the one in southern Gaza. So 4 people were injured, moderately and slightly, according to medics in the Gaza Strip. Last Friday, 2 young men were killed by an Israeli drone in western Gaza City, in the Shad refugee camp, just last Friday. So the likelihood of casualties among civilians is high, is still high, out of the frequent Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip. The people here in Gaza, the civilians, always pay the price for the Israeli attacks on the territory, despite the fact that this is coming out of political maneuvers, political controversy by the Israeli ikhlans, by the Israeli politicians.
That was Rami Al-Megari speaking to us from Gaza on Wednesday. For much more updates and analysis on the recent and ongoing attacks against Palestinians, go to electronicintifada.net. Last month, Palestinian-American soccer fan Buthaina Hamad attended a soccer match to cheer on Honduras as they played the Israeli national team at the BBVA Compass Stadium in Houston, Texas. According to a report in the Free Press Houston, quote, 15 minutes into the game, Nathan Buchanan, head of security at the stadium, removed her from her seat, surrounded her with four Houston police officers and three additional stadium security personnel, and prohibited her from returning to her seat until she surrendered the flag. Hamad stated that the head of security, quote, told me I am not allowed to carry this flag because it implies a, quote, racial slur. I spoke with Hamad last week and asked her to begin by telling us why she went to the soccer game and what happened.
Well, I went there. It was a planned event. We planned it over a month and a half with my boyfriend and his family. So his mom, his dad, his sister, his brother-in-law, one of his brothers canceled, didn't go. But that was my reason for going, was going with the Honduran family. I brought with me a Honduras jersey, which I wore, bought from his mother from Honduras. She had taken a trip over there. And my Palestinian flag. When I went there to hold the flag, I held it in front of, this is complicated for me to describe this, like where it was in the stadium, because one of their responses from BBVA was that I was blocking the aisle, I was blocking views. So I want to make it clear, I was standing in a position that was not blocking anybody. You walk up the stairs from the concourse, then in front of you is the stadium, and then you walk to your right and left and there are seats. You go up the stairs from there. So the only thing that was behind me was the stairs up from the concourse. No seated people, no, it wasn't obstructing any view. So, I mean, that was after me sitting down watching the game. And the reason why I felt I could stand there was because I saw several other people standing there and several other flags hanging from that one spot. So my boyfriend and I walk over there and we're hanging the flag and we're cheering for Honduras. Nowhere in the time of the match did I exchange any type of verbal obscenities with a fan of Israel. So it was just cheering for Honduras, and I wasn't even using the obscenities that the Spanish speakers were using at the time against Israel. So, you know, no profanities. And then I was told to sit down after a few minutes, and I go and I sit down, and I was told a moment later by the manager to stand up and you know, come with me to the concourse. I walked with him, and as you know, there was several security and HPD officers waiting as a show of force. And the first question he asked me is, why are you carrying that flag? It wasn't a question I thought of in advance, because it's something people do. So when he asked me, why are you carrying this flag? I said, I'm Palestinian. So he goes, they're not playing. And I said, no. So they have nothing to do with this match. I said, they have everything to do with this match, because I'm here and I'm representing Palestine and I'm wearing a Honduras jersey and I'm cheering for Honduras. So this is the reason why I brought the flag. So then that's when he tells me later that my flag implies a racial slur. And that's when the conversation just goes, like, really? Are you really telling me that this flag is a racial slur? And that's when it goes on to the statement that I had written. I'd asked him several times, what country am I in that you are denying me entry as a patron, that you are telling me that I cannot carry this flag? Like, what country am I? And I've been to Israel, Palestine, and I've been treated a certain way, and I've been to other countries where you're at their mercy. So I'd asked him several times, and then I'd asked him, why I can't carry this flag? This is what people do. And I said, would it be okay if I carried a U.S. flag? He goes, yes, that one's okay. So on to tell him that I'm not here as a hooligan. I was telling him that I was there with his family. I was there with this. I was there. I wasn't doing anything wrong. And he wanted the flag. He wanted to take the flag from me. So I was telling him, I'm not going to give you the flag. Listen, I told him, listen, I will keep the flag. It was wrapped around my shoulders. I won't wave it. if you are going to like threaten me with those two options, but you're not taking this flag. So finally, after I threatened him and I said, how would you like it when I out you and I let everybody know that you as the representative of BBVA treated me today, that's when he offered me a two-part compromise. And the first part was giving me what I wanted, which was the ability to retain my flag and to go back to my seat. And the second one was, here's a business card, I'm looking out for your safety. Or he goes, call me if anybody bothers you. So at this point, BBVA is claiming that I was there to instigate Israeli supporters, that I was blocking the view, that I was blocking the aisle, that I was just being disruptive. And then they also saying that they were being proactive in the sense of their safety. I was on the Arab Voices radio show, and they were invited to the show, and they didn't come, but they released a statement saying, we apologize for the poor use of terminology. However, we stand behind our actions to be proactive in the arena of safety. So if they had an issue with safety, that would have been the first thing out of their mouths, not that my flag was racist.
But Anna, how are you fighting back, and have civil liberties organizations come to your defense?
We honestly, right now, it's the voice through ADC. ACLU has said they're interested. Palestine for Civil Rights is a national organization. Also, another civil rights organization, they're interested in participating. And right now, what I'm doing is going using them as an outlet for a voice. And they have been very successful with sending letters to the mayor, to the city of Houston, to the chief of police, to BBVA, and explaining the seriousness of this issue. So there's been a lot of support with civil rights groups.
And finally, will you go back to the stadium, and will you bring your Palestinian flag next time?
That is a very good question. I actually intend to go back to the stadium on July 26th, and I'm going to start, I've started a Facebook page, which I'm going to start again on a campaign where our intentions are to go watch the Dynamo versus Aston Villa. Our intentions are to support Dynamo. This is our local Houston club. And also for the Dynamo org to see the number of community members that are upset with this, whether they are Palestinian or American or Arab, it doesn't matter. That I'm hoping to address this with the presentation of Palestinian flags in support of the Dynamo match. We're not there to start any problems, but we're hoping that Dynamo.org would pressure BBVA to at least give us the respected and deserved apology. Not me, period, but the whole community of Palestinians who are upset about this. So this is our plan. We're going to start a PayPal for everyone who wants to buy their tickets, because I'm going to secure at least 20. Yes, it's to maintain the awareness that this community is upset with what was said from BBVA. And this is the number of people that represent your fans and, you know, the Palestinian cause.
That was Puthena Hamad in Houston, Texas. And finally, we go to Chicago with this report from Nader Ahmoud.
Fadi Farah, known to his customers as Jordan, went from begging friends to let him practice cutting their hair at his uncle's shop to owning his own barbershop 7 years later. Farah, a 20-year-old Palestinian-American, bought Chicago Fades last Thanksgiving. Farah's parents came to the United States as newlyweds from the Palestinian village of Turmus Aya in the occupied West Bank with the purpose of starting a new family and supporting those who stayed back home. Fadi, who will be married in August, will use his success to support his new family and those who are still back in Turmus Aya.
Started cutting hair when I was in grammar school. All through high school, I was cutting hair also. A lot of my clients are from the school I went to.
Fadi never went to school for cutting hair. Instead, he practiced on friends at his uncle's barbershop. Najah Awad was the first brave soul to donate his head for practice.
To me, he was like my little brother. You know, I've known him all my life, and he's known me all his life. So when he came to me about the idea of him becoming a barber, you know, I wanted to support him. Back then, I would have never expected him to be like this.
Fadi's first try was a failed attempt. Najah remembers walking out of the barbershop bald. But Fadi's early mistakes have helped him become one of the most established barbers in Chicago's Northwest Side. Fadi estimates that he has 500 customers, and on his busiest day, he will give between 50 and 60 haircuts. He credits a lot of his early success to the Palestinian community that he grew up with in Chicago. Over 100 of his regular customers are Palestinian Americans, he says. Because of the high volume of patrons, Fadi doesn't take appointments and does not give his friends special privileges, such as cutting in line. His best friends and family members are left sometimes waiting over an hour for a haircut, if they come on Friday or Saturday, Fadi's busiest days. Fadi's first stint ended after 3 years at his uncle's barbershop, the Faden. He took his few talents only a few blocks away to another Palestinian-American-owned barbershop, Fade by Tom. For the next 4 years, Fadi would continue to better his craft, build his clientele, while developing the courage to branch out on his own.
Actually, from the old place I was working at, I actually took all my customers and half of their clients, too.
Because of the amount of clients Fadi brought with him to Chicago Fades, he says tensions are high between the nearby Palestinian barbershop owners. Today, there are three other Palestinian-American-owned barbershops within 2 miles of Chicago Fades.
How does your uncle feel about this?
Doesn't feel real good about it. Not at all.
So there's a little rivalry.
Yes, yeah. A lot of rivalry, actually.
Despite his success at being a barber and a business owner, Fadi's dream is to be a Chicago police officer in the narcotics division. He recently received his associate's degree in criminal justice and completed an internship with the Chicago Police Department.
I wanted to do that, but I got my own barbershop now, so I'm going to do this for now, and then in the future, if I want to pursue the career in criminal justice, I'll go on and do that.
For the Electronic Intifada in Chicago, I'm Nader Hamoud.
And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis by our team of writers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. You can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and on behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.